Much of this, of what I'm going to discuss, was lost in the middle of the COVID-19 epidemic this year. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. Do you remember Earth Day back in the 19th? This is a youth sermon, so I'm asking, do you remember when Earth Day hit in 1970? But Earth Day, I think most of our young people understand the whole Earth Day, Save the Planet, Green Earth movement that had its roots even farther back before then, but it really came to a focus in 1970. I'll quote from an article from BBC.com Future Planet titled, How the Largest Environmental Movement in History Was Born, by Sophie Yeo, April 21st, 2020. Aging protesters still speak of the first Earth Day with reverence. On the 22nd of April, 1970, 20 million people took to the street. I don't even need to look over at you folks, because you're not looking at me, are you? You're looking at the screen. I'm not going to look at you. Okay, and I'm not going to look at you. I'm going to look at these people. I may glance at you people over there, but okay, I'm back. Sorry, I've had a stepped out of the situation here. I'm back, focused. Okay. So they took to the streets across the United States to protest environmental destruction. The nation had recently witnessed the devastating impacts of the Santa Barbara oil spill and seen the first photographs of the Earth taken by astronauts. The beauty of that blue marble pictured from space contrasted bleakly with the lamentable state of the Earth that they knew from the ground. This campaign was led by a senator from Wisconsin, Gaylord Nelson, and organized from a temporary office in D.C., staffed by college students, many already veterans of protest campaigns of the 60s, including the civil rights movement. But anyone was free to arrange their own festivities. That was the remarkable thing about Earth Day, wrote Nelson. In his book that he wrote later called Beyond Earth Day, it organized itself. When you think of some of the commercials, again, to those folks of us who are around back then, there were several commercials that made an impact on me as a child that I can remember. One, of course, was that, you remember that cigarette commercial? Not that I was tempted to smoke cigarettes when I was 8, but I was tempted to chew tobacco. My dad let me try tobacco. Wise decision on my dad's part, because that was the only nicotine that I ever took in my body when I swallowed it and never took it again. But anyway, okay, so back to the cigarettes. Do you remember the cigarette commercial where the dad's interacting with his son? They're talking, and father like son. Son does everything that his father does, and then dad takes out that pack of cigarettes and starts smoking. And then I think it ends with the kid kind of fiddling around with the cigarette packet. So a very powerful lesson. I remember that one. Of course, the other one I remember is don't squeeze the Charmin. With Mr. Wimple, I believe was the fellow, but he would come up and if you squeezed the Charmin, he was right there. How many of you actually squeezed the Charmin at some point in a grocery store? Okay. All right. Good. I did as well. Okay. There was another one that I'm not going to play today, but it was put together by Keep America Beautiful. Now it's keepamericabeautiful.org, but I'll paint the picture. Some of you are probably already ahead of me on this. There is an Indian, a Native American, paddling his canoe down this beautiful river in the forest, and then he comes out of the forest, and then all of a sudden you're seeing trash, and he's in the middle of a city, and then he's standing there, and somebody drives by and has trash in the car and throws it out and hits the Indian at his feet, and he's just looking at the devastation all around, and then you see that tear come down from his eye. How many of you remember that one? I wanted to play that today, but I don't think it was legal to do that, so I didn't, but incredibly described, though. What do you think? Huh? Did I? No, seriously. Remember the that that particular commercial made a tremendous impact on me as I thought about the trash that we saw. I picked up trash along the road, but in Ohio, but back then you could get a nickel, of course, if it was a bottle. So I was always looking for those. But back to the issue. Environmentalism's roots go back much farther than this, but things really began to take off after this. Warnings of an imminent ice age that could be coming, to be later replaced by dangers of global warming, the warming of the polar ice caps, flooding of the earth. Movies depicted situations like that. There's still some come out, and now it's morphed to the whole concept of climate change and the impact of climate change on our life. This whole subject has been, what would you say, slightly politicized? Slightly, maybe? As we're seeing this, but it's hotly debated. Scientists differ on this subject. The present mantle carriers are folks like Greta Thunberg and Jamie Margolin. What are you, as this is a family day, youth day, those of us who are youngsters here, and those of us who are in college and in high school, what are you being taught in your science, in your history, in your social studies classes regarding this? Does mankind have a responsibility to slow climate change? Can mankind even affect climate change one way or the other? Is climate change even occurring? Has climate change always been an effect, in effect? Ebbing and flowing over time? Is mankind taking care of this world as he ought? Who determines whether we are taking care of this world as we should or not? How do we gauge that? How is that observed? What does that look like? And what does all this have to do with the Feast of Tabernacles? What does it have to do with the Feast of Tabernacles? The title of today's message is Save the Planet? Did you notice I tried to create a little inflection at the end? That's what means question mark. So, save the planet? That's the title. Young people, I'm not so young, but you and I, all of us here, are very blessed to be granted to understand the precious truth of how the planet will be saved. Not only saved, but healed. Part of why we're here today observing the Feast of Tabernacles, part of what we just saw in that beautiful video as we listened to Yana's performance. I want us to take a look at this today because it's critical that you and I understand this, and not only this situation, but also understand our part in it as God's people. You, young people and college students, you are not taught this in public education. I think I can say that pretty emphatically. You are not taught what we know in public education. Our college students are not taught this. Now, if you're in a homeschool, depending on the curriculum and depending on the parents who are teaching it, you may be taught this in your science classes. But by and large, it is not taught. And yet God provides us with a very clear understanding for his people. Let's go to Genesis 1. Let's look at a thread here as we begin to develop the thought in our message today. Genesis 1, and to understand the concept or the thread of what's going on with the whole issue of saving the planet and also the healing of the land. Genesis 1:31, we go through, of course, the recreation, the reforming of the earth after the satanic rebellion. As we see between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, we get to the whole recreation. We come to Genesis 1:31 as he finishes the 6 days of creation. In verse 31 of chapter 1, then God saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very good. It was pleasant. It was agreeable. All put together in a very pleasant, agreeable way. So the evening and the morning were the sixth day. So we come over then into the situation of Adam and Eve being created there. Of course, they were created on the sixth day. They're instructed by God about what to do. We've heard about that and what not to do, and we know what they did. So let's look now at at this statement, because this statement is critical in our understanding of this whole earth. Genesis 3, verse 17. Then to Adam, God, as he's talking here to Adam, as a result of Adam and Eve's decision, Genesis 3, verse 17, he said to Adam, because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of life, and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat of it. Of course, that was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What's he say here? Cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the herb in the field. In the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground, Adam. For out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. Let's look at Genesis 6 as we come to the point of the flood occurring and the impact of man's evil, which led to God choosing to send a flood on this earth. We think about that as you're turning there, this whole cursed is the ground, cursed the curse of the land. It's very critical for us as God's people to recognize that. Very critical for us as young people to recognize that as we reflect upon the situations that we're taught now in school about what we can do to save the planet. Adam and Eve were told to tend and care for the garden. And as God put mankind in dominion over all of that, it is critical that we do so. And again, who determines how we do that appropriately? I would say again, God does. And God lays that out in the Bible. We want to look at that today. But he says, cursed is the ground. Genesis 6, verse 5, as we get into the whole situation of what led to the flood, verse 5. Then the Eternal saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Eternal was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So he said, I will destroy man whom I've created from the face of, I'll destroy him from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah, of course, found grace, favor in the eyes of God. So he did that. He did that. He destroyed all of that. And as a result, we see him then coming back to be a part of the land. This is a critical understanding that God has given us. It is something that we can take to the bank, that we can understand as we see even the issues that are going on in the world out there of climate, the issues of what mankind is doing in some cases caring for the land and in some cases not caring for the land. One of the things that we can take to the bank is the Noahian covenant here that God made with Noah. Let's look here. Genesis 8, verse 20. So this is as they're able to come out of the ark, as verse 19 says. Genesis 8, verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Eternal, and he took of every clean animal and every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Eternal smelled a soothing aroma. Genesis 8, verse 21. Then the Eternal said in his heart, he said, I will never again curse the ground for man's sake. Although the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth, nor will I again destroy every living creature as I have done. Verse 22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, winter and summer, and day and night shall not cease. We can take that to the bank. There are always going to be seasons until the earth is no more. There is going to be seed time. There is going to be harvest. But what does he mean when he says, I'll never again curse the earth? Is he saying he's removing that curse that he gave to Adam? He's not saying that. He's talking specifically about cursing the earth in terms of total destruction as he did with the flood. He said, I'm not going to do that ever again. He says, until it all ceases, while the earth remains. And that's very important. This is not fiction. This is not fiction, what happened here. Look at chapter 9, verse 8. Chapter 9, he spoke to Noah and said to his sons with him, saying, As for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature with you, the birds, the cattle, the beasts of the earth, all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Verse 11, thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. That's the curse that he's talking about. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. No, a water world with Kevin Costner is not going to take place. Okay, it's not going to take place. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud. And it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. It shall be when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow shall be seen in the cloud. And I'll remember this covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. The water shall never become a flood to destroy all flesh. God is saying something very important there to Noah again. He's reminding them of the relationship that the Creator has with His creation and with mankind. And in terms of with the creation, also with the land and the waters, verse 15, never again become a flood to destroy all flesh. This is real. This is real. When we see the rainbow in the sky, do we think of this? Let's continue the thread. Let's go to Deuteronomy 11. We begin to see, this is a parallel passage to what Mr. Trabig covered yesterday in Deuteronomy 6 as he went through that very effectively. Deuteronomy 11 spends a little bit more time with talking about God's connection to the land and His connection to the land with the people of the land. In this case, he's talking to Israel. Deuteronomy 11, verse 8. Therefore, you shall keep every commandment which I command you today, that you may be strong and go in and possess this land when you cross over to the Jordan, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Eternal swore to give your fathers, to them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. This land, he makes a differentiation here as he's dealing with his land, Israel, God's land here that he's claiming for Israel. He says, this is a different kind of land to which you're entering. Not like the land of Egypt from which you've come, where you had to sow your seed and water it by foot as a vegetable garden. But this land, which you cross over to possess, Israel, it's a land of hills. It's a land of valleys. It drinks water from the rain of heaven, from the heavens, from the skies, a land for which the Eternal, your God, cares. God, that's a very powerful statement there. God is attached to that land and His people of that land. A land for which your God cares. The eyes of the Eternal are always on that land, from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. Verse 13, and it shall be that if you earnestly obey my commandments, which I command you today, to love the Eternal your God and serve Him with all your heart, with all your soul, then I, who takes care of this? Who takes care of caring for the people through the land? The Eternal God, the Creator, the one who created all things through Jesus Christ, God and His Son that are there on the throne. I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain, the latter rain, the different rains that help with the cultivation of the crops and the latter, all of that as that's going, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine and your oil. And I am the one, God says, I am the one who will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. So he says, take heed to yourselves, lest your heart get deceived about all this, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them, lest the Eternal's anger be aroused against you. And he, God, is the one who does it. And he shut up the heavens so that there be no more rain, and the yield and the land yield no produce. And you perish quickly from the good land which the Eternal is giving you. Very important concept that God wanted Israel to understand. How many in this nation today would you say recognize that? That that's the real principle that's going on in terms of the birthright promises and all that God has done and what God has wanted on that level for their ability. These individuals, as we know, did not have God's Spirit. But to recognize that and follow that principle, that connection of God to the land and to his people. This passage gives us a key, again, of how God desired Israel, and especially us today now, spiritual Israel, to connect with God through his creation, through the abundance that he desires to give us, and our result and appreciation of that. Just let's look at an example. Okay, we know that the Sabbath is tied to creation, right? We understand that. Let's turn to Leviticus 25. Mr. Trabig touched on this a bit yesterday. So we know that the Sabbath is tied to creation. God rested on the seventh day. We keep the Sabbath weekly to remember that he is creator, that he is creator of the land, that he's creator of all things. As well as we keep the Sabbath as Deuteronomy 5, thinking of Mr. Gerke's sermonette, that we were liberated from Egypt. That's another reason for keeping the Sabbath. But as we look at Leviticus 25, we see also a tie in to the land. Leviticus 25, verse 1. And the Eternal spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the children of Israel, say to them, when you come into the land, this land again that we talked about, that God keeps his eyes on day and night, which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Eternal. The land is to keep a Sabbath. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But the seventh year, there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Eternal. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Now what grows of its own accord of your harvest, don't reap, nor gather the grapes of your untended vine, for it's a year of rest for the land. The Sabbath produce of that land. So what they're saying then, as we look here, as you read through verse 6, the Sabbath produce, that land that we're that year that we're not going to be tilling and pruning and working the vineyard and all of that. He says you can eat of the produce of what grows of its own, but look what it says here. The Sabbath produce of the land shall be for you, for your male and female servants, your hired man and stranger who dwells with you, for your livestock and the beasts. That shall be for food. But it's not to be for a harvesting and a storing and a selling. It's just to enjoy during that time. That's the way God set it up. That's the way God set it up to understand his creation. Look at Leviticus 25, verse 8 now. Leviticus 25, verse 8, we get into the year of the Jubilee. So you've got 6 years of laboring, and the seventh year you rest that land, and then you go through that again, a seven-year period, and you come all the way to seven of those. So you're at the 49th year. The 49th year is a Sabbath rest for the land. And then the next year is the year of Jubilee, the 50th year. And this is a special time. You think of being alive at that time. How many Jubilees would a person get to experience? I mean, really experience, to where he or she kind of knew what was going on. Maybe they were 11, 12, 13. I'm not saying that a 10-year-old doesn't know what's going on. But whatever that age is, you know, if you were maybe 10, then when you're 60, you get to experience that again. Maybe several got to experience it a couple of times in their lifetimes. For how long Israel faithfully even kept this system. But anyway, verse 8, you shall count seven Sabbaths of year for yourself, seven times 7 years, and the time of the seven Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. And then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the seventh month, on the Day of Atonement. So you shall make the trumpet sound throughout all the land. consecrate this 50th year. And as Mr. Gerke referred yesterday to this perfect law of liberty, proclaim liberty throughout all the land to its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee year for you. And each of you shall return to his possession, and each of you shall return to his family. The 50th year shall be a jubilee to you. In it you shall neither sow nor reap what grows of its own accord, nor gather the grapes of the vine, for it's the jubilee. It shall be holy to you. You shall eat its produce from the field. Think about this. We're going to talk about this in a second, but just think about this whole construct being in place, what that would have been like, what that would have been like during that time for those who kept that faithfully. What might it be like in the millennium? Let's finish the thought here, and then we'll discuss it. Let's go to verse 18. We'll read through verse 22. So you shall observe my statutes and judgments and perform them, and you will dwell in the land in safety. And then the land will yield its fruit. You will eat your fill. You will dwell therein safely. And if you say, well, what are we going to eat in the seventh year, since we shall not sow nor gather in our produce? I mean, we're an agrarian society. I've got to survive. I can save up after the sixth year and have enough to get me through till the next harvest. But what am I going to do if in that whole next year we don't sow and we don't reap in that respect? He says, then I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year, and it will bring forth produce enough for 3 years. And you shall sow in the eighth year and eat old produce until the ninth year. Until its produce comes in, you shall eat of the old harvest. I mean, can you imagine that kind of a system set up? One is with the Jubilee, you know, everything back then was about land. Land, because it's an agrarian society. I just want to ask a question here of the people here. How many of you, I'm not talking about folks who have gardens and this and that, how many of you, your livelihood depends upon this kind of an agrarian, I'm saying you actually make your income from farming, your primary income is from that. How many here are in that situation? Two. And they're sitting beside each other, so I got a feeling they might be one. Am I guessing correctly? Sometimes I'm really intuitive and I can pick up on things like that. One. Think of that. Think of the way that God set that up, this whole agrarian society, for folks to be tied to the land and tied to God as creator. And here we are. We're God's people. And out of all of us, the way society has gone, we've got one family, only one righteous family in the whole. No, I'm kidding. But one family in our whole group here at Kerrville. And we're kind of out in rural America right here. You know, it speaks to the way that we have become separated from the land. Something that God did not intend from the beginning. Something that God will not see happen in his millennium. He'll bring us back. He'll bring mankind back to the land. I was thinking about Mr. Trabig's comment about what that reading of the law. Remember we talked about that yesterday, the reading of the law in the seventh year. And to have that at that time, because he was thinking about, conjecturing that it may be that God's wanting them to, hey, remember this. You have gotten some people have gotten in some debt and this and that. We need to make sure we get that clear. Take care of your people. Don't oppress individuals. Think about, and I'll add to that, in terms of this situation. Imagine this. Here they are in the seventh year. They're at the Feast of Tabernacles and the law is being read and they're reading this passage right here. And they're recognizing, yes, that is right. We did not sow the land this year. And remember what happened last year at the end of the harvest? That harvest was unbelievable. It was so abundant. We were storing and storing and storing. It was like our apple tree in Ohio that just apples came down forever. Apples and apples and apples. 99 quarts of applesauce that lasted. Well, actually, Mother probably still has some that will last until through... through probably the Great Tribulation and place of safety, if we're able to bring that there. But all of that time, a huge, huge blessing. So they're experiencing that. They're realizing as they're keeping the feast, they're looking back at that year and seeing all that God has done to bless that. They are tied to their Creator through the Sabbath. They're tied to their Creator through the land Sabbath. They're seeing how He is the one who provides and gives and blesses and grants. And they see the liberty that God has given them, as was talked about in both the sermonette and the sermon, in people getting back, being able to be released from that bondage. We even see land coming back to individuals in the Jubilee. A miracle. Who caused this to happen? Who caused this incredible miracle to happen as we're in that seventh year and we're seeing this? It's God. It comes back to God. It comes back to God. And the people, through the land that God has given them, see God as their Creator. Think about Mr. Black's sermon when he talked about the events leading up to the return of Jesus Christ. Remember we talked about the seven trumpets and the thirds, the one-thirds, third of the land destroyed, third of this destroyed. Let's go to Joel 1. I don't know how they said it back then. Probably the folks from Galilee just said Joel. I don't know. The city folks said Joel. I don't know the... All right. Using up time. Sorry, I shouldn't be doing that. Joel 1. God is Creator. God is the one who is in charge of the land. He controls that. Joel 1, verse 15. Alas, for the day of the eternal, the day of the Lord, is at hand. It shall come as destruction from the Almighty. Who is going to save the planet? Who has the potential to destroy the planet? Who is the creator of the planet? It shall come as destruction from the Almighty. Verse 16, is not the food cut off before our eyes? Joy and gladness from the house of our God? The seed shrivels under the clods. Storehouses are in shambles. Barns are broken down, for the grain is withered. How the animals groan. The herds of cattle are restless because they have no pasture. I won't cover some of this, as this will be covered later. But look in the middle of verse 20. For the water brooks are dried up. God has been responsible for that. Think of the seven trumpets, and then think of the last trumpet. Mr. Black talked about the last trumpet and the dead in Christ being raised. And then what's a part of those trumpets? It's the seven last plagues. Now what happens with the seven last plagues? Full of the wrath of big business, of this, of that. Full of the wrath of God. Every living sea creature dies. Every living sea creature dies because of God's wrath. Rivers and springs of water become blood. Scorching sun, thunderings, lightnings, earthquake, an earthquake more powerful than since mankind has been on the earth. Unless those days are shortened by the Creator, no flesh is saved alive. That situation is not sustainable. It's not sustainable. The earth cannot continue to exist. And I know we've written in our literature, and this is true over the years, that mankind has the capability to destroy himself times and times and times over. But that is, my opinion, as I look at Scripture, that is part of it. Man left to himself would have the ability to destroy himself. But I submit to you that it is the Creator, and it is the Creator in His wrath that has to have His wrath quelled in order to save the people. Remember Malachi 4:6? I'll send Elijah the prophet in those last days, and he'll turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, children to the fathers, unless God comes and smites the earth with complete destruction, as the Hebrew brings out there, with a curse, with complete destruction. God must be the one who saves mankind, and he quells his wrath. He's the one who's in charge, and he is the one whose wrath is quelled. But even in the situation when Jesus Christ returns, and these seven plagues have been poured out upon mankind, that situation, if God were to stop it all right now, the earth at that point is not sustainable. It's not sustainable. All would eventually die. You've got all of the sea creatures dead, all of the water areas, rivers and springs of water becoming blood. It must be healed. But again, as we know, the Creator defeats the armies of the dragon, and he saves the planet. Jesus Christ, the King of Kings. Let's go to Ezekiel 47. I was looking at the babbling brook in the video that we watched as the violin piano piece was played. Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, the one through whom God created all things, saves the planet, and he begins to heal the land. Those of us that have been in the church for years recognize this very important passage in Ezekiel, because it gives us such a beautiful picture of the healing that begins to occur, but not only that, from where it begins and from whom it comes. Ezekiel 47, it's that situation discussing the water coming up from under the throne. Then he brought me back to the door of the temple, the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. Ezekiel 47, verse 1. And there was water. There was water that was flowing from under the threshold of the temple. Well, the water across the land is blood. The entire sea, the oceans and the sea, all of life is dead in that. But we see water flowing from under the threshold, originated from the place where the Creator is, the healer of the land. For the front of the temple, toward the east, for the front of the temple faced east. The water was flowing from under the right side of the temple, south of the altar. He brought me out by way of the north gate. He led me around the outside of the outer gateway facing east, and there was water running out on the right side. So they started measuring it, and I won't go through the detail of it. They go out a certain distance, 480-some yards, and it's up to the ankles. Then it's up to the waist, and then it finally gets to the point in verse 5 where he measured out about a mile, or more. And it was a river that could not cross, for the water was too deep where one must swim, a river that could not be crossed. He said to me, "Son of man, have you seen this?" "Yeah, I've seen it. I saw it. It's incredible." Then he brought me and returned me to the bank of the river. When I returned there, along the bank of the river, were very many trees on one side and the other. So we see life springing forth from this water from the Creator. Verse 8, and he said to me, "This water flows toward the eastern region. It goes into the valley and enters the sea. When it reaches the sea, its waters are healed. And it shall be that every living thing that moves, wherever the rivers go, there will be a very great multitude of fish, because these waters go there." God is healing that. Christ is healing all of that. "And everything will live wherever the river goes. It shall be that fishermen stand by it from En-Gedi to En-Eglaim." En-Gedi, located on the Dead Sea. So that's coming to life. There will be places for spreading their nets. The fish will be of the same kinds as the fish that were in the Great Sea, the Mediterranean, exceedingly many. The swamps and marshes will not be healed. They'll be given over to salt out to the outside, but the Dead Sea will be healed. Along the bank of the river, on this side and that, will grow foods of all kinds, will grow all kinds of trees used for food. Their leaves won't wither and their fruit will not fail. They will bear fruit every month, because their water flows from the sanctuary, from the place where the Creator is. Their fruit will be for food and their leaves for medicine or for healing. we begin to see, as time goes on through the millennium, as this unsustainable situation begins to be sustainable, as we see it originates from the cleansing that Jesus Christ initiates from the throne. And then next, let's go back to Joel. We begin to see mankind's connection again to the land as God intended. We see Israel being brought back to the land and being given their land again. That was part of the Jubilee. Give them, at the end of the 50 years, give them back the land, because God wanted them to be tied to the land to understand Him as creator and provider for them. But they come back. And God connects them. Of course, we know that not all obey, and as Mr. Black talked about, but that is even tied to the land. Oh, if we don't obey, we don't get rain from God, the one who gives rain. We don't get that from Him. It's tied to the land, tied to the Creator. Joel 2, let's go to verse 18 now. Joel 2, verse 18. This is the area just before what Mr. Giese started covering. Joel 2, verse 18. Then the Eternal will be zealous for His land, and He'll pity His people. The Lord will answer and say to His people, "Behold, I will send you grain and new wine and oil, and you'll be satisfied by them. I will no longer make you a reproach among the nations. I'll remove from you the northern army and drive him away into a barren and desolate land, with his face toward the eastern sea and his back toward the western sea. His stench will come up and his foul odor will rise, because he's done monstrous things." Of course, we see in other passages God healing all of that as he over time begins to work with these nations and bring them to him, and they'll rejoice in the same kinds of blessings of Israel. But he says, "Fear not, O land." He personifies the land here. God says, "Fear not, O land. Be glad and rejoice, for the Lord has done marvelous things. Don't be afraid, you beasts of the field, for the open pastures are springing up. The tree bears its fruit. The fig tree and the vine yield their strength. Be glad, you children of Zion, and rejoice in the Eternal your God, because He's the one who's given you the former rain faithfully. He is the one who will cause the rain to come down for you, the former rain and the latter rain in the first month. The threshing floor shall be full of wheat, and the vats overflow with new wine and new oil. So I will restore to you the years that the locust has eaten, the different things that God sent upon them in His anger at their disobedience, the crawling locust, the consuming locust, the chewing locust, all those things. You're going to eat in plenty, verse 26, and be satisfied. And when you do that, you're going to praise the name of the Eternal, your God, who has dealt wondrously with you. This is that being that is working with mankind and working with them with the land. We see another element of this healing that I won't spend a lot of time with, but it's critical, because it doesn't end with the healing of the land. It's God uses that and ties that to help them understand how He's also healing them. God's connection to the land and God's connection to His people. Joel 3, we won't turn there, but it talks about acquitting them of their bloodshed as he blesses them with incredible abundance. Let's do take a look at Isaiah 30. Give a shout out to Dr. Levy. He had mentioned this passage to me that he had heard back in, I think, his college days, and I had not seen this one, so I'll cover that. Isaiah 30, verse 22. Just after your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, walk you in it. Look at verse 22 now. This ties again Israel's connection to their Creator and their following God and the healing that takes place and how it's attached to the land. You'll also defile the covering of your images of silver, the ornament of your molded images of gold. You'll throw that away as an unclean thing. You'll say, "Get away, I'm done with that." Then He will give you rain for your seed, with which you sow the ground. Yes, mankind will still be working the ground, and but we see places where the briar and the thistle and those won't be there. He'll be working with that. Continuing, with which you sow the ground and the bread of the increase of the earth, it will be fat and plentiful. Maybe I shouldn't say flat. Is that politically correct? It'll be an enlarged waistband with an unloosened belt and plentiful. In that day, your cattle will feed in large pastures. Likewise, the oxen and the young donkeys that work the ground, they'll eat cured fodder, which has been winnowed with the shovel and fan. There will be on every high mountain and on every high hill, rivers and streams of water. In the day of the great slaughter, when the towers fall. Moreover, the light of the moon will be as the light of the sun, and the light of the sun will be sevenfold, as the light of 7 days. In the day that the Eternal, yes, he's healing the land, but he's also healing the people. In the day that the Eternal binds up the bruise of his people, and he heals the stroke of their wound. He does it, and the blessings are tied to the obedience as they put away the idols of the land. One of those idols of the land is the land itself that some appear to worship. Isaiah 27, we'll just turn back a page. Isaiah 27, look at the imagery here. The imagery here is talking about the overall restoration of Israel. And he's talking to Israel as if it is a vineyard. It very much ties in with John 15 and how we must be connected to the vine. We won't go into that, but notice what he says in verse 2. In that day, sing to her a vineyard of red wine, speaking of Israel. I, the Eternal, keep it. I water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. Who would set briars and thorns against me in battle? I'd go through them, I'd burn them together, or let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. Verse 16, those who come he shall cause to take root in Jacob, and Israel will blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. Again, God uses the land to teach Israel again about his love for them through the blessings. They see his love in abundance through them as he is healing them spiritually. So much planting and that we see in the imagery there that's going on. That I want to look at one more before we segue to the latter portion of the message. Amos 9, verse 5. Amos 9, verse 5. I'll try not to trample too much on Dr. Levy's message tonight. He gave me permission to do this. So I'll cover this portion here in Amos 9 as it speaks directly to the message that we're covering today in terms of tying the land with God as creator and also the healing of the land, the healing of the people. Amos 9, verse 5. The Eternal God of hosts... Again, who is responsible for everything? To whom does God want mankind to turn and to look as being the creator and the sustainer of all things? I mean, that's a no-brainer. He's going to take mankind back to an understanding of who he is and how he provides for all. The Eternal God of hosts, he who touches the earth and it melts. He's the one who has the power over that. And all who dwell there mourn. All of it shall swell like the river and subside like the river of Egypt. He who builds his layers in the sky, he and has founded his strata in the earth, who calls for the waters of the sea and pours them out on the face of the earth. The Eternal is his name. And then he says in verse 13, behold, the days are coming, says the Eternal. This very famous passage of which we've heard many years, those of us that have been in the church, when the plowman shall overtake the reaper and the treader of grapes, him who sows seed, the mountains shall drip with sweet wine and all the hills shall flow with it. I'll bring back the captives of my people, Israel. They shall build the waste cities and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and drink wine from them. They shall also make gardens and eat fruit from them. I will plant them in their land. God's in the process of healing. He's also in the process of planting people in their land. And they aren't going to be pulled up anymore, rooted up and burned. They shall no longer be pulled up from the land I have given them, says the Eternal, your God. Non-agrarians that we are, may we always remember what God is doing with the land and the way that God wants us to be attached to Him as Creator as we live in His land, and how He's going to bring mankind to an understanding of who He is through the land that He loves. Very, very important. Very, very important for us as parents, as we work with our young people that are in such a digital society, to get them out in the land and get them out to see their Creator in the land, the creation of the wondrous things that God does, while not worshiping the creation. Okay, now, as we begin to move to the latter part, does that really sound awful when the minister says, he doesn't say I'm moving to my final scripture, but he says I'm moving to the latter part of the message. I'm really going to try to be on time here. Okay, Romans 8. Let's go to Romans 8. Save the planet? Romans 8. Because this starts getting in. I mean, that's kind of the big picture, but this is really the big, big picture. Okay, we're getting into the big, big picture now. Romans 8, verse 19. For the earnest expectation of the creation, the expectation of the creation itself, God has, you know, recreated this earth. Yes, the earth is under a curse, but he's stepping forward a bit here. The earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. And this is a very future thing here. It's not talking about us now. It's talking about the revealing of the sons of God, at least for what I can gather here, about being changed to spirit beings. But the creation, he says here in verse 20, the creation itself, even the millennium, even the physical creation of things being restored, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope. Because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs until now. So, what I think he's getting at here is this concept of how he has created this earth, and in a sense personifying that, creating a mindset for us to realize that it eagerly looks toward the being completely liberated, and what does that liberation look like? We get a taste of it. We get a taste of it in the millennium because he restores things back to the way he originally set it up in the Garden of Eden. And God, in God's way, is going to teach mankind that, yes, following me in this physical life, even with God's Spirit in us, following me creates blessings. I'm going to show mankind that this can be done and that this will work, and it creates joy and peace and all the things of which we've heard so effectively preached this feast to help mankind see that. He's going to show them that it can work. But he also wants us to taste more. Deuteronomy 4, saw this couple of weeks ago. I thought this was an interesting statement that's nestled here in the middle of of talking about beware, being staying clear of idolatry. Deuteronomy 4, verse 19, Deuteronomy 4, verse 19, he says, "Take heed, lest you lift your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and the stars and all the host of heaven, that you feel driven to worship them and serve them." And that's to some degree behind some of these movements that are out there, but in an absence of God. "Driven to worship them and serve them, which the eternal your God has given to all the peoples under the whole heaven as a heritage." God has divided that, as the margin renders, "forgiven to all the people under the whole heaven as a heritage." And I think, again, what I gather from that passage, on one level, yes, God created mankind to be over the creation as a heritage. But I think he's speaking more to that. I think he's speaking as much as well of way out in God's end game, out into the future. Of the heritage that God is giving all peoples under the whole heaven ultimately as a heritage. You know, you think of some of these different sci-fi and fantasy books that are out there about, you know, in a sense, where this life come from. I think of the Shannara series, where there's the Elkris tree that it protects everybody from the evil forces, and you've got to keep that tree healthy because it gives life. Remember that was Avatar, that movie where they went to that one planet, Pandora. Sorry about this, you non-sci-fi people, but they went there, and there was the what was that tree called? The Tree of Souls that you could tap into and get life from that. You think of those of you that have seen the Lord of Rings trilogy. You've got the Ent that goes and he's the oldest living creature on the planet, and he protects the forests. And the Maloran tree of where the Lady of the Woods is, and it brings health and restoration. All of these things, I think, you know, ultimately are people trying to kind of barely tap in to something that is a truism that we understand. Could it be just as much Satan's way of creating these kinds of things? Yes, probably. But there are two trees. There's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and there is the tree of life. The tree of life. The tree of life eternal. That's to what we look. We look to the millennium. We look to the healing of the land. But we also recognize that the whole creation yearns for the revealing of the sons of God, because God wants to give mankind spirit created mankind as his heritage, all things. Revelation 22. We see the imagery of the new heavens and new earth when all death has been put away, and yet he comes back to the land, but it's a different kind of land. It's a new heavens and a new earth, a new land, a new healing. A healing that has eternal significance. God is bringing mankind into eternity. That's what he wants to give us. He wants to give us eternity, to come into that existence with him as our God, as part of the God family, to recognize the eternal nature of God, of what it is to understand joy, of what it is to understand perfection and completeness in the fullest sense, the true liberty. God wants to give us that, and all of that, the healing of the land. We see the imagery again of the healing of the land talked about here that goes into eternity. Revelation 22, verse 1. "And he showed me a pure river of water of life. It's as clear as crystal, and it proceeds from the throne of God and of the Lamb." He's not talking about Jerusalem when Jesus Christ came to the earth in Ezekiel 47. He's talking about the new heavens and new earth coming down. God the Father is there, and the real water, the water that is the water of eternity, of incredible perfection and beauty that is beyond our ability to understand. proceeding from the throne of God and of the Lamb. And in the middle of its street, on either side of the river, was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. There shall be no more curse, no more curse, but the throne of God and of the Lamb shall be in it, and his servants shall serve him. As we look at the situation that we see in today's world, brethren and young people, we've been given such an incredible look into eternity. And that look, that understanding, guides and directs our understanding of how we are to follow this great God, this great Creator, who will not only heal the land in the millennium, save the planet and heal the land, but create an environment of perfection in every way with his offspring, whom he loves, and over the land whom God loves, the land of the universe in its perfection.